going to record this myself. And what I'm presenting here on behalf of myself and Veronica Lipinska, who's in the audience, is a very much a work in progress. It is somewhat different from the initial topic that I submitted to this when I was so kindly invited to be part of this workshop. I was originally going to be talking about science and journalism. And in a sense, what I'm doing here is talking about a sort of, you might say, a kind of a special case of the intersection, one that is very recent, very ongoing, I think will be very important in the future. This is what I'm going to be presenting here is the basis of a book that Veronica and I are writing for Palgrave Macmillan. And with regard to issues of discourse analysis, we are both people who are interested in studying the discourses surrounding the two kinds of principles I'll be talking about here, precautionary and proactionary. But we're also participants in this debate. We are people who support the proactionary side. Okay, if you want to get a sort of initial grasp of what the difference is, I mean, I imagine most people in this room have heard of the precautionary principle. And the precautionary principle is very much associated with a protective attitude toward the environment and to health in general. It has been very much advocated as a sort of international legal principle that should be binding on countries, and so for all of the major global environmental conferences that have taken place over the last 20, 30 years, the precautionary principle has been presented as a foundation for all sorts of legislation. And you might say the precautionary principle is a kind of do no harm principle. It's kind of the Hippocratic Oath writ in the largest possible sense. It is, generally speaking, a risk-averse strategy toward a whole wide range of areas, from scientific and technological innovation to environmental and health policy. One of the interesting features about the precautionary principle is that one of the things that gets contested about it is the very fact that it's a principle. Because in the legal context, a principle is typically something that is understood as a sort of taken for granted foundation on which law can be made. So in other words, one says, well, you know, we already presupposed a precautionary principle in the way in which we make legislation, so it's no big deal really to endorse this. Okay, and this is something that in particular the United States has very much objected to. So now in the sort of global legal documents concerning environmental policy, whether we're talking about Rio or Copenhagen or all these other places where these attempts have been made to have global environmental legislation, precautionary is called an approach rather than a principle. Okay, but it's intended as a principle. I think that's a very important point. If you do, you know, if you look at Google, there is roughly 1,450,000 hits on the precautionary principle. It's something a lot of people have spoken about. It's got a very substantial entry in Wikipedia, and so it's a very current sort of concern. Now, the proactionary principle is, in many respects, the diametrical opposite of this. It's actually, you might say, part of the spirit of the precautionary principle is a sense in which human beings need to reintegrate with nature. And in this respect, the do no harm principle, in a sense, is do no harm to nature, and that is the best way you will do no harm to humans. The proactionary principle, in fact, starts from the opposite premise, namely that, in fact, to be a human being is actually to take calculated risks that turn out to be right enough of the time that we are able to continue to distance ourselves from nature. And in this respect, the proactionary principle tends to stand very much for innovation in science and technology, and is not actually afraid to use the word progress as what is the main value of directing its orientation. Now, the proactionary principle is a much more recent principle. On the one hand, the precautionary principle, you can already find it formulated in German in the early 19th century. There is a, in this form in German, let's see if I get this right, yes. And so in 1804, you have it formulated by the director of forestry for Prussia, Georg Ludwig Hirtig. okay? And it was a save the forest principle initially. Okay, and the idea was that each generation should leave the next generation with the same amount of resources, so subsequent generations can enjoy them to the same extent than the current generation does. That was the original context in which the precautionary principle was put forward, and it was seen as a kind of householding principle, where in a sense, instead of just talking about how you manage your farm or your state, one could talk about all of nature in this regard. And that was the origin of the precautionary principle. In contrast, the proactionary principle only dates from the year 2004, 2005, and it's very closely tied to the transhumanist movement in its current formulation. And this is both a plus and a minus. And part of what Veronica and I are doing in the book and this is where, in a sense, the critical discourse analysis part of what we're doing comes in, is that while we are sympathetic to the proactionary principle, we actually don't like the way in which it positions itself in the argument against the precautionary principle. We don't like the way in which it kind of stands for itself. In a sense, it accepts too many of the assumptions of the precautionary principle, and I'll be saying more about that in a few minutes. But I want to say something about the origins of the proactionary principle. There was a major conference that took place in 2004, which was basically organized by, when we talk about transhumanism, I should say, we mean a rather broad church of people who go, let's say, who include on the one hand people like Marvin Minsky, one of the fathers of artificial intelligence, and including some more recent contributors such as Ray Kurzweil, who many of you may know as a popularizer of the singularity principle and the idea that one day we'll be able to upload our consciousness into machines and things like that. He's certainly counted among the transhumanists, but also counted are people who some of you may be familiar with in the United Kingdom, Aubrey de Grey, who is a person who says that all we need to do is to find the right genetic switches and we'll be able to live for 1,000 years. Now, that's a different sort of transhumanism because it's one that, in a sense, wants to optimize the human body as it's biologically given rather than, let's say, moving to a more durable form from carbon to silicon, which is kind of what the other guys are up to. But the point is you've got this very broad church of transhumanist people who basically say that human beings are on the threshold of becoming quite radically different creatures if we're willing to take the risks, and that the risks, as it were, are within our midst and that they're rational risks to take. A kind of a manifesto, a set of principles were formulated in the paper Veronica and I submitted. You get to see the latest version of what that is, we want to comment on some of the ways in which the proactionary people present themselves at the moment. If you do the Google hits on the proactionary principle, you don't get 1,450,000, you get 35,000. Now, admittedly, the precautionary principle has been around a longer period of time, and certainly in the 1980s it started to acquire a global international legal constituency. The proactionary principle does not have any of this at the moment. It really is kind of a sort of niche ideology, as it were. But actually, we think that this has the potential for being a very serious kind of alternative. And to give you a sense of where we're trying to go with this, we actually think that in the 21st century, if you want to redefine the right and the left, which for the last two centuries has defined the political polarities, in the West at least, I think precautionary versus proactionary will be the new poles for the 21st century in terms of quite different attitudes toward risk. I think one of the points that needs to be made here about the concept of risk, there are a couple of things to be said about it. The first point, and I think this might be of interest to especially to Arya Kruglansky, that there's a sense in which the precautionary and proactionary people do not so much disagree on the assignment of risk. So they don't necessarily disagree on the numbers, as it were, but they disagree on threshold matters. Okay, so in other words, that's what risk aversion amounts to, right? Risk aversion, you know, amounts to, in a way, you know, finding too much risk too soon. Okay, but not necessarily because you measure the risks differently. So from a cognitive standpoint, there may be agreement, but there are quite different motivational action consequences. Okay? And I think that's really where the key disagreement goes. Now, in a way, I'm idealizing a little because, of course, there can be some disagreements about risks and so forth. But even once you sorted the science out, you might say, there is still this fundamental ideological difference. Okay? And that's a point that Veronica and I are making a big deal about, because it does have consequences for what sort of policies are exactly associated with a pro-actionary position. What does it mean to take calculated risks? I mean, there's a sense in which we have some fairly good paradigms of what it is to protect the environment, to protect health. And in fact, not only the environmental protection movement, but also one may talk about the classic development of the welfare state in the 20th century as having a very strong precautionary element, right? So the emphasis on preventive medicine, right? On healthy eating, don't drink, right? The whole idea of trying to narrow the range of behaviors within society so they come within certain norms that then make the society administrable. Right, because in a sense, the welfare state is about trying to administer to a large group of people, and one of the things that you want to do is to have a sense of the variation within which their behaviors are going to take place, so that you actually have something that can be governable. Okay, and so there has always been a strong precautionary element to the welfare state, and this is tied to other aspects of the welfare state as well, which I'm not going to go into here. But I think it is not by accident that the countries that initially championed the welfare state were, relatively speaking, certainly by their own lights, biologically homogeneous. Okay, so in other words, the genetic possibilities for having different diseases, different sorts of lifestyles, were minimal at the beginning. And I can say more of that if you really are interested in that aspect of the issue. But so the precautionary principle isn't merely about environmental protection as it's interpreted today, but actually is very deeply rooted in certain conceptions of the welfare state. Now, with the proactionary principle, the main problem that it has, you might say, in terms of a backstory, right, is that at the moment it's just being championed by these transhumanists, very few of whom actually have any kind of secure academic posts. Many of whom, the ones who do have secure academic posts are not necessarily in fields that are directly relevant to what the principle is talking about. And there is no real obvious connection with politics. In fact, there is a strong connection with the science fiction community, a strong connection with certain kinds of art movements, science art, bio art type movements. Right, movements interested in body modification, things of that kind. That's very much part of where the proactionary principle comes from, but it's not really tied into any kind of mainstream political discourse. To give you a sense of the contrast again, and add on top of that, I would say that for the most part, the transhumanists who present the proactionary principle are fundamentally anti-statist and libertarian. Okay, so there's a sense in which these are the people who see themselves as the party of progress, but it's very individualistically understood. And so there's a sense in which there is no motivation, you might say, within the current formulations of the proactionary principle, and this is one thing I think that Veronica and I find about their literature, that has any kind of awareness that there needs to be some governance structure to enable this to happen. Okay, so there's no real politics behind this. There's more like an advocacy of free choice. That's kind of as political as they get. And that's not really sufficient. So that, I think all of those pieces of the puzzle need to be kind of put out there in order to appreciate the kind of challenges that we have in trying to defend the proactionary principle. Now, the guy who put forward the proactionary principle is a guy named Max Moore, which is a pseudonym, right? But he's obviously trying to emphasize how he's trying to do as much, maximize. I mean, that is quite deliberate, okay? And in a way, it's one of the reasons, in a sense, this kind of thing doesn't help the rhetoric of the movement very much, where you have a guy named Max Moore who wears a leather jacket and tells you that, you need to be taking all sorts of risks if you're going to fulfill your life as a human being. You know, it's kind of like a more academic version of James Dean or something, okay? And that's not really kind of the way we want to go. By contrast, to give you a sense of how strongly the precautionary principle has made it into mainstream politics, the Green Party in the UK, recent, which now has one member of parliament, recently put out a white paper called Guardians of the Future. And this is basically, as it were, setting up what they call an ombudsman, whose job it would be to have oversight over all legislation passed in Parliament and to basically have it recalled if it looks like it's going to endanger future generations. Okay, and this is one way of trying to institutionalize the precautionary principle. The Green Party in the United Kingdom has endorsed. Apparently, it's based on a model that is in use in Hungary. So there is a kind of mainstreaming going on of this kind of principle in the way that is not with the proactionary principle. Okay, so what I want to do here is to review some of the issues involved. The first thing I want to say is the issue of risk is an important one to get on the table. Now, when we talk about, there's always this kind of, what should one say, confusion or ambiguity about the relationship between risk and uncertainty. And I think one very important book that provides a kind of benchmark for the discussions of this is Risk, Uncertainty, and Profit by Frank Knight, which came out in 1921. I don't know, have any of you heard of Frank Knight? Frank Knight is one of the founders of the Chicago School of Economics, way back before Hayek or any of those other guys, Milton Friedman, got involved. Okay, he was the one who was the head of the department who, in fact, hired Hayek and some of the early people of that school. And this work, which I think is actually still worth reading, not least because it has no mathematics in it, it's actually qualitative. This is back in the old days, right? It's a qualitative understanding of what's going on with risk and uncertainty. And basically what Knight is talking about is basically the idea of risk as managed uncertainty. Okay, this is what the idea is. Risk is managed uncertainty, where your unknown unknowns become known. Right? What Knight was arguing about how the economy functions, and this then becomes kind of the way in which the notion of risk gets taken forward in cost-benefit analysis later on in the 20th century, is you have to imagine something like profits that happen in the capitalist system as, you know, in a way a bit mysterious. How is it the entrepreneur is able to make more money given all the initial investments and things that he puts into it in terms of hiring the labor and getting the capital together and everything, and yet he makes a profit? Okay, is it because he knew how to do things better? No. In fact, the argument is, according to Knight, that it was an accident. He didn't know the situation. He just acted, and it turned out to have a good consequence, and that's the profit. But then, when you think about what is the consequence of having the profit, well, then there's a learning experience that takes place, not only from him, but for all the other people in the market who are watching him, right? Because in a sense, a market is a kind of collective learning process. And so people then begin to get a sense of what it was that this guy did that succeeded. And so in a sense, what seemed like blind uncertainty, where he was just taking a chance in introducing a new innovation into the market, you then begin to get a better sense of what it was that he did was right, that was wrong, and then other competitors are able to enter into it. And what happens over time then is that the uncertainty gets managed as risk, and people can talk about the costs and benefits of going into a certain field. And so that then rationalizes the uncertainty, makes the risks calculable, and then you get a more managed economy. This is what Knight was arguing. Well, in a sense, the proactionary principle likes this general idea that there is a sense in which that human beings do need to take some initial blind risks, you might say, where one doesn't know the consequences of actions, but then be very ready and willing to learn once those consequences take place. Okay, and it's through learning from mistakes or learning from success that one then is able to have a more expanded economy, more progress in science, and all the rest of it. Okay, and that's the proactionary attitude. And that what that requires is you actually do a lot of things in a state of ignorance. In other words, so it's very, again, you know, the precautionary principle is if it's uncertain and you don't know what's going to happen, don't do it. But the proactionary people are saying that actually it's only by acting in states of ignorance that you actually have a chance of learning something very substantial. I mean, some of you who are familiar with Karl Popper's philosophy of science may see a kind of similarity there, right? And I think that there is a similar line of thinking going on there. And that is very much in the proactionary mode, right? So in a sense, risk is something to be welcomed and to be managed. Okay, and so that's a really different attitude, because for the precautionary people, the unknown unknowns never get known. It's always uncertain. It's always problematic. You never know what's going to happen, so you have to plan for the worst case scenario. Okay, and in fact, that idea of the worst case scenario, whether we're talking about ultimate environmental disaster or health disaster, that is the kind of thing that the precautionary principle always throws up, you know, as something to be concerned about. And the proactionary principle denies that as an appropriate way to think about the problem of how do we do policy for the future. Because in the end, this is what these people are arguing about, right? What should be our long-term future policies in all sorts of fields? And you might say that there are two sorts of arguments that go against the idea of the worst case scenario that the proactionary people put forward. One idea is just simply the idea that the worst case scenario is just improbable, that you cannot do policy for a very improbable case. You should do policy for more likely cases, or at least a range of likely cases. And the other one, which I think in a way is a much more complex one, but quite interesting, is how exactly do you calculate what the worst case scenario would be? And here I would say that one of the costs, the kinds of, because you can think about different kinds of costs, you might say, that come from taking, that can come as a result of taking risks. And one sort of cost that the proactionary principle is very sensitive to, much more so than the precautionary principle, is opportunity costs. That is to say, what do you end up losing by not having acted? Okay, so in other words, inaction has a cost. Okay, and so there it becomes, you know, and this is a very interesting kind of argument in a way, because there's a sense in which, in principle, this creates a sort of sense of urgency on the part of the way in which some of the rhetoric of the proactionary principle comes. Namely, there are all these things we could be doing that could potentially be improving the human condition, but we are just holding ourselves back. We're just holding ourselves back out of fear of the unknown. Okay, so that's very much part of the proactionary rhetoric. Now that sounds very good, and we do endorse this, but there is a downside to it, and that is, and because what I've just described to you is very much kind of the ground on which the proactionary people typically like to pitch their debates with the precautionary principle, right? Namely, that it's a matter that we are missing out on valuable opportunities, and so it is urgent that we act on things in terms of putting a lot of money into the kind of research that could engage in genetic switching to increase our lifespan, stuff of that kind. The problem is that it ends up becoming an argument between the two sides over fears and threats, right? I mean, it's almost like a Cold War style scenario, right? Where the precautionary people are saying, you know, that there are all these risks out there, that if you end up, you know, sort of going full steam ahead on certain kinds of scientific and technological innovations, you know, you'll end up destroying the world. And then the proactionary people say, oh yeah, well, not doing it will destroy the world. Right? So you've got this kind of face-off taking place at the level of fear and threats. And what you don't get is you don't get actually the positive image of what the society would look like under the proactionary regime if it were to work. Rather, you get this sense that if you don't do what they're saying, these other guys are going to ruin things. And so at the moment, the debate occurs at that level, and because of the political imbalance between the two sides, the precautionary principle looks much stronger. Okay, and so what's needed then is a kind of a positive view of what the proactionary principle is up to. Let's see, 20 minutes. How long have I been speaking? Do I want to?
You started at 10 past, so you still have 15 minutes.
Okay. Because I want to tell you the positive story, or what might be the positive story. And this has to do basically with the idea of how. Well, let me start. The basic plan here, you might say, what is lacking, I've already mentioned this, is that the proactionary principle, however attractive one might find it, doesn't actually have any kind of discourse of politics or governance attached to it. How would you actually implement this? How would you actually run a society that actually encouraged people to take a lot of risks? Because in a sense, prima facie, that seems much more problematic. I mean, you can understand how the old welfare state worked because basically it was trying to prevent people from taking risks. But now we're saying we're trying to encourage people to take risks. But what does such a society look like? You can easily imagine such a society being a nightmare. Right? Now, it's not, they don't realize this because these people tend to be libertarians. And they believe all risks taken are individually undertaken and individually absorbed in their consequences. So there isn't this kind of larger social concern. But this is something that we, in fact, have. And so what we need to do, at least this is what we are working on, is actually developing a discourse of the welfare state for the 21st century that actually embraces the proactionary principle. So it'll be a kind of welfare state like you never saw it before, because it'll actually encourage divergent forms of behavior, divergent forms of risk-taking, but nevertheless will provide a kind of social security for it. That's the goal, okay? That's how we're going to try to square the circle on this. It's not easy. And there are a lot, but there are some interesting kinds of precedents that one can draw on. And one precedent that at least got us thinking along these lines, Veronica contributed. Veronica is a big fan of the novelist Michael Crichton. Okay, and the last novel that he published before he died was called Next. I don't know if any of you have read this novel, and it is basically about big corporations basically coming to own the human genome and all the problems that causes. And in the postscript to that novel, there Crichton, speaking in his own voice, basically says that the state actually should prevent any kind of intellectual property regimes from taking place over any kind of human genetic material. That should be made impossible for, and that the state instead should be the owner of the intellectual property, as it were, that's in our genome, to protect the people from the corporations. This is what Crichton says, and Crichton's not known as any kind of left-wing fanatic by any means. Okay, and he says this will ensure human freedom, because the kinds of scenarios that come up in the novel include ones where, because a corporation owns genetic material of somebody, they can actually prevent that person from doing things if it looks like it's going to endanger the genetic material. So the corporate ownership of your genetic material can end up constraining your freedom, and that's the thing that he's concerned about. Now, we are sympathetic to this idea, but there is a question about what is the freedom for? Why do you want to protect people's freedom? Okay, so we have to have a sort of more... and so here we want to draw on the proactionary principles kind of conception that to be a human being is to be a rational risk seeker. And that, in a sense, the reason why you want to have this freedom, the reason why you want to have ownership over your genetic material, is so as to be encouraged to actually take certain kinds of risks with that, take certain kinds of risks with the endowments that you have. Okay? Now, we realize that not everyone would want to do this. Okay? So it's not like you're going to force everybody to take all kinds of drugs and things like this. But nevertheless, those who do, right, should not be penalized. They should be, in fact, they should be encouraged. But also, whatever information comes about from their actually engaging in this risk-seeking behavior should be made generally available and made part of some kind of common knowledge that could then be used to inform scientific practice, medical practice, people's behaviors, and things of that kind. And that this whole, you know, the whole, you might say, social infrastructure that this would require, whether we're talking about the information gathering aspects, because, by the way, the information is already being gathered on people's behavior all the time through the internet, through all kinds of unobtrusive measures, right, normally by corporations. So it's not like what is being asked for here would require all that much more surveillance than is already taking place implicitly in the society, but rather there would be a kind of public interest in having access to it. It wouldn't be privatized, because it would have the, and to support the infrastructure involved, not only for the information gathering, but also for putting it to public use, and also to provide for the medical attention and other forms of compensation that might be necessary for the people who do take the risks and maybe do not succeed as they would like and so forth, there would be taxes. So this would be the people who don't participate, but who nevertheless may benefit from the experiences of other people who do take the risks, they would be among those who subsidize it. So it wouldn't be just in single individuals taking the risks and bearing the consequences, whether positively or negatively. Rather, this would be seen as a collective product, project of the society. Okay, so whoever wants to take the risks could take the risks. Then there, as it were, enough revenue collected so that it would be possible to actually subsidize whatever care and treatment is needed for these people, especially in cases of failure. Okay, now it seems to me the proactionary principle, if it is going to be a principle that actually enables society to be empowered and to be advanced and so forth in the way in which the people who propose it seem to think, that you need something like that kind of infrastructure in place. But what that entails at a rhetorical level is a very open acknowledgement that all of this risk-taking may lead to a lot of failure. A lot of people will take drugs and treatments and volunteer to do it. I mean, one of the things that Veronica and I are considering is the idea of having a right or a duty to participate in scientific research as part of normal enfranchisement. You might think of it as a form of national service. Okay? If you're willing to go to war, why can't you go into an experiment? You see? I mean, those kinds of things. But, of course, all of that acknowledges there will be failures. But at the same time, if you want to encourage risk-taking in the society, those failures in some way have to be dealt with in an appropriate, respectful, whatever, concerned manner. I mean, because I do think that it's very easy to talk the rhetoric of risk-seeking and all of that, and we do live in a society where there's a greater tendency to want to have permissiveness and a more libertarian attitude and all of this, and that's fine at a certain level, but it's not clear that you actually get a long-term social benefit of the kind that actually leads to progress in the sense that the proactionary principle is talking about, unless you actually have a strong state security system. Now, the final point I want to leave you with is kind of what does this society look like if you actually had it? Okay? And I think this is, again, part of how do you, you know, the discourses of utopia, right? What is it that we are looking for? I think one of the big rhetorical problems talking about the proactionary society in practice in the way we've been proposing it is that it really strains our notions of tolerance. Okay? One of the things about liberal society, if you think about classical forms of liberal theory, often liberalism is expressed in terms of, you want to enable people to have the most freedom possible that is compatible with everyone else having the same amount of freedom. Right? So you don't want one person's freedom constraining somebody else's freedom, but rather you want to have jointly maximizable freedom. Okay? Now, that was always a kind of easy, in a sense, what made the idea in principle easy to implement. Certainly, if you look at somebody like John Locke and all these 17th century guys we're talking about, 18th century guys, is that they imagined human beings to be roughly equal. Roughly equal in their abilities, in their capacities, in their desires, and when it got right down to it, in their actions as well. Right, and that whatever differences were caused in society, let's say class differences and so forth, they were artificially imposed by the church or by a king or something like that. But that if you actually removed all those things, people were naturally roughly equal. I mean, this is in the American Declaration of Independence as well, a kind of natural equality of people. But you see, the proactionary principle could strain that notion very severely, especially if you imagine people trying all sorts of different enhancements and some of them succeeding. Some of them failing, and some of them succeeding, right? And also, if you start talking about people wanting to mix genes with the creatures, or let's say engage in a cyborg existence, where let's say part of their being would be android being, I mean, we can't rule these things out as possibilities. If you're actually encouraging these alternative forms of being, right? Can you actually have a liberal society that enables all of those people to live in the appropriate lifestyle that is, you know, for their capacities, together, not as segregated communities, but as part of one society mutually benefiting and mutually learning from each other in the sort of classic model of a liberal society? Okay? Could you stretch tolerance this far? Okay? And I think this is a very serious sort of question that, again, the proactionary people do not currently address because they have this libertarian backdrop. where in a sense they're thinking purely in terms of individual choices and not thinking in terms of what the collective consequences are of those choices being taken. Okay? So I guess I want to end here because I do think this is a very exciting kind of project to be engaged in, you might say, because what it does is, on the one hand, the proactionary principle and the discourses surrounding it are clearly in a sort of unformed, infantile stage. There are relatively few people involved in it. They're relatively marginal people. I mean, but it's the sort of thing where one can get involved and become much more active and sort of, you might say, improve and expand the notion to give it a certain kind of political respectability and make it a more interesting kind of thing to discuss. And I think it dovetails very well with, a lot of other issues that are sort of on the horizon with society today, given that we are seeing people continuing to explore, either legally or not, alternative ways of being in the world. And the question is, what would be a society that actually put this in the open and actually tried to encourage it to happen for collective benefit? So I will stop here and take some questions, maybe? Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, Harriet.
Really sounds like a very exciting project, and I look forward to reading the book. In thinking about these issues, I was wondering whether psychology could not be of some help.
Yeah.
Because psychology has done a variety of different research that bears on the issues of risk and uncertainty. There are individual differences, there are motivational differences. At least three different literatures come to mind that will be directly pertinent to the idea of giving uncertainty and risk a good name.
Yes.
One is the work by Torrey Higgins at Columbia on prevention versus promotion orientations. Mm-hmm. Prevention orientation is exactly the precautionary principle. Promotion orientation is exactly the proactionary principle. So there is an extensive literature how these states can be induced, what are the individual differences, where they spring from. Very relevant. Another literature is the literature on closed-mindedness. The idea is that closed-minded people are those who find uncertainty aversive and avoid it. They freeze on the status quo. They are reluctant to entertain alternative ideas. They are, they are conformists. They protect their in-group. They are intolerant of diversity, intellectual and otherwise. So this is the literature on need for closure and need to avoid closure. Again, these are motivations that vary across cultures. So you could predict what cultures are likely to be adopting the precautionary principle or proactionary principle more readily. Mm-hmm. There are individual differences, situational differences. There's a whole literature on that. And the third literature is on the two components of self-regulation, which is assessment. You first assess where to go, and then you go. Assessment and locomotion. And again, there are individual and situational differences in the tendency to locomote. The literature finds that people who are prone to locomotion are ready to take risks. All they want is change, moving ahead, advancing. People who are assessment-oriented are very cautious, calculating risks, being risk-averse, and so forth. So these three literatures and the situational, cultural, and individual components of them could be quite pertinent.
No, this is very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Jonathan was Jonathan Potter over there had hand up.
Hi, Stephen. Veronica, that was really interesting. As we know, there's often a rather loose connection between highly generalized rules of this kind and specific practices.
Yes.
I'm wondering how much what you're suggesting is actually a transformation of people's behavior and how much that this is offering a couple of different kinds of vocabularies for reconstructing it. Now, I guess that would be a classic discourse analytic in the 1980s sense of looking at this and say you've got two repertoires available and people can reconstruct their actions in a precautionary or proactionary way for different contexts. So So I'm wondering what this is politically.
Okay.
Is it an ideological reconstruction, or is it actually a program of action?
Well, it's a program of action in the sense... See, one of the reasons why we want to contribute to the pro-actionary discourse is that we want to, as it were, enlarge in its constituency. Because at the moment, the pro-actionary principle, as it's stated, you know, in the paper that was part of what we circulated, really only appeals to libertarian types, it seems to me. And in fact, you might say at the moment the debate between the precautionary people actually have there's a wide umbrella of people who travel under that principle, the precautionary principle, even if they interpret it somewhat differently. The pro-actionary principle actually doesn't enjoy that big tent status at the moment. It's seen as very much a niche preoccupation of certain kinds of libertarian people who've read too much science fiction. And so I do think that there is a kind of, you might say, constituency building function in you might say, elaborating the discourse, you know, and drawing other discourses into it to show that it's not just this freakish thing, but in a sense, you know, you can give it as, you know, as sort of deep a backstory as you can to the precautionary principle. Because I think what makes people find the people often find the precautionary principle attractive partly because it's been very well articulated, right? And there's been a lot of debates about it. And is it where that history adds a certain gravitas, which at the moment is currently lacking from the pro-actionary principle. You know, but of course, you know, in both cases, lots of different people will travel under it. That I certainly will grant. But I think that there is a kind of unevenness in between the two sides at the moment because the pro-actionary principle hasn't really been developed very much. That's why I mentioned the number of Google hits originally, right? 1,400,000 versus 35,000.
Well, if I can answer this question.
This is my co-author. Yeah.
Thank you for this question. Well, what I would like to highlight here would be what we've got this knowledge for. So we're collecting the knowledge we've always been. It is out there. It is accumulated. And now we have this feeling that all the current discourses actually take place within one very stable, concrete principle, namely precautionary. So all the discourses currently developed has this background that has never been questioned. And therefore, to shape current discourses, it would be better to go back to the principles and see if there is something else that we can explore. So by uprooting ourselves, we can actually enter the whole new area of discourse and knowledge. And we also believe that since people have all this knowledge, we can maneuver around it and we can redesign the freedoms effectively, if that answers your question.
So thank you for the talk. I was a bit surprised to see you assigning us a prioristically at the position of the conservative, the bad guys, as in favor of the precautionary principle at the very beginning of your talk, taking you took a position, at least that was very clear. So I was a bit surprised at that in the sense that in sociology, I'm not a sociologist, so my question might be sound naive. There is a lot of studies about controversies, controversies in science. So I would have expected maybe a stance also taking this field as a topic more than as a resource for assigning positions, and I was thinking, for example, at the work by Michel Caron and others about, I think the 2001 book was translated in English, so Acting in an Uncertain World.
I know, I reviewed it for Contemporary Sociology.
Okay, so you know what I am speaking about.
That was very critical.
So I think that one of the things that we learn from Latour and Caron is the very fact that those positions where people are considered as taking risks and rely very much on discursive and expert practices defining what a risk is, It seems to me that the problem begins with those very practices defining something as being a risk or not, and then on the basis of this kind of controversies and discursive, and not only discursive practices, the distribution of positions. So are you interested in that or not?
You might say I presuppose it and move on. What I do is called social epistemology, right? And in a sense, there's a sense in which you can talk about how risks are constructed and deconstructed, and you can still take a position on things, right? I mean, the project, at least in terms of my own project, yes, of course I know about these people, and if you know anything about my work, I'm in this sort of a conversation with them. But my orientation is normative at the end of the day, and I think this is a very interesting kind of site because, first of all, it's one where I think it's going to have increasing salience. So the aspect of the precautionary principle that I say is, I think the precautionary principle replaces the old conservative position. If you want to talk about the right-left polarity, okay, it's up to you whether you think, I mean, yes, it's true. For me, conservative is kind of a negatively marked word, but that's my personal opinion. But I do think, as a matter of fact, that the precautionary principle leads you in a more conservative direction with regard to policy matters as the word conservative is normally understood, even though a lot of the people who hold the precautionary principle think of themselves people of the left. Okay? And that's the extent to which I think the political polarities are shifting. You might say becoming orthogonal or something to the old 19th century right-left division. Okay? But look, at the end of the day, I think, you know, what we're concerned with here is actually developing the proactionary position, even though it's not like I'm denying the kinds of things that Latour and Collin and all these people have come up with, but at the end of the day, it is still possible to have a position after that. It's not like in some sense that doing the descriptive analysis incapacitates you politically, which is kind of what you're suggesting.
Well, I am suggesting that maybe as a first step, a good analysis is not so bad.
There's lots of, I mean, let's put it this way. I think you got to do both at the same time, especially if we're talking about an ongoing development, right? We are participants as well as describers in this process, and I made that clear at the very beginning. And I think if you take this kind of, I think it's a kind of academic cop-out of saying, oh, we've got to get the analysis exactly right before we can say anything that's of policy relevance or normatively significance, we'll be saying nothing. And in fact, that's what happens to most academics, right? They just are analyzing till the cows come home, right? Because there's always more to construct and deconstruct, right? And it seems to me what you need to do is do both simultaneously. And especially with this matter, where I think it's the positions are, I mean, the precautionary position, while it's quite diverse, is fairly well established, okay, in the political arena. The proactionary principle is still very much a work in progress. So there is an interesting participant observation character to this thing as well, especially if one is enthusiastically trying to get involved in it, okay? But I don't think, I mean, I think if you say you have to analyze something wholly before you can say anything normative about it, you'll never say anything. This is part of the risk-taking. See, this is the thing. This is part of the risk-taking, is actually getting involved in normative discussions while a lot of this descriptive stuff is still rather unclear about who the interests are and how the risk is being constructed and stuff like that. Yes.
That's not what you think. I have a question. A comment first, in that a couple of corporations have come to us and said, we are looking for people who are futurists.
Mm-hmm.
People that...
Send them my way.
Because so many times we are super bright people, but they are stuck in their ways and they can't really figure out what's going to happen before it even happens, or see trends before they even happen. And they use this same words that you're using, people that can move from the known to the unknown and take uncertainty with so much exploration. So I wonder if what you're saying is that and it's kind of what I was trying to allude to earlier, my talk about being in this old age versus more this rapidly changing where everything's new, and we're stuck. Things are changing too quickly to predict, so we just need to figure out how to get people to be truly more futurist or innovative in their thinking and
this uncertainty, that they almost embrace uncertainty as a way of life rather than I have to know. And other generations things were more certain than they are now.
Yeah, yes, in a way I agree. I think I would have one caveat, and that is what it means for people to embrace uncertainty can go in lots of different directions. And I think sometimes when people embrace uncertainty, they just become skeptics, right? So in a sense, whatever's happening now, it'll change in the future, and there's no reason to actually get interested or involved in anything, right?
Problem solved. I mean, but I think what I'm talking about is people that are trying to solve future problems.
Yeah, no, and that's fine, and that's fine. And I guess the key part of this embracing of uncertainty, I didn't actually mention the word here, but it's very much part of what we're talking about, is this idea of reversibility, because it's part of what happens when you take the chances, you move in a certain direction, you find out, in fact, it's not what you thought it was, and you have to change course of action. You have to be mentally prepared to see that.
Yes.
Right, and that's the reversibility aspect of things, and in a way, I think that's a very good way of talking about the kind of mental, you know, mental disposition you need to have.
Would you agree if I say that the world right now is facing the results of the application of the rational principle to the financial global markets?
Everybody's been asking me this question whenever I've talked about this. Yes, that may be true, and it's an interesting issue. You know, you think about the arguments that have been had about should we bail out the banks, right? Everybody's been having this discussion, and in a sense, you might say if you take the financial crisis discussion as an analog to what I'm talking about here, then it would look like we would be on the side of the people who would bail out the banks, right? Because they're the risk takers. Right, and when they go, you know, and in a sense, they come up with the stuff that people benefit from, but then there's a lot of risk involved, and every now and then those things fail. But what do? Just let them die? I mean, no, we have a responsibility to enable them to continue. I mean, I'm not saying I actually buy that argument with regard to the banks, but that would be kind of the analogous argument, you might say, to the argument that I'm making with regard to securitizing risk-taking in the pro-actionary polity, right? In a sense, you would bail out the people who would take the risks and suffer as a result. And so you'd be bailing out the banks in that sense. But, you know, within the economic argument, I mean, I realize it's very unpopular to bail out the banks, but certainly within a kind of Keynesian economic framework, that is what you would do. Because of the risk-taking, you want to keep the risk-taking going to a certain extent. You know, so, I mean, but you're right, you're right. There is, and that might be an invidious kind of analog, but it is there, yeah.
I think we should now give the floor to...
Okay.
Yeah. No.